The Catra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Catra AI.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Deep Dive. Today, we're diving into a really significant, maybe even unsettling book. It's Elizabeth Colbert's Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future.
Yeah, this one, it really makes you stop and think. It fundamentally challenges a lot of common ideas about environmentalism, about humanity's place on Earth now.
Right. Colbert is basically tackling the biggest issue of our time, the Anthropocene, this idea that humans are now the main force shaping the planet.
And the book digs into this incredibly difficult question. Okay, we've changed the world, maybe irreversibly. Mm-hmm. So what now? How do we actually manage this altered planet?
Exactly. It's not just about reducing our footprint anymore. The book argues we're kind of stuck in the driver's seat running the planet's systems, whether we like it or not. And that's the central paradox Colbert keeps coming back to. It's a real gut punch, actually. Every problem we've tried to fix with technology seems to create new problems that need, well, more technology.
So we're caught in this loop.
Pretty much. The choice isn't intervene or leave it alone anymore. It's more like, which kind of intervention do we choose now? And they often get bigger and riskier. Under a White Sky is like a field guide to this new, strange reality.
Okay, before we get into the specific examples, and they are wild, let's talk about the author. Who is Elizabeth Colbert? Why should we listen to her on this?
Well, she's got serious credentials. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner, writes for The New Yorker. She's known for really deep scientific reporting, but also for telling compelling stories.
She makes complex stuff readable.
Exactly. She goes to these places, talks to the scientists on the ground. She brings this rigorous journalistic approach, but makes it feel very human, very immediate.
And this book, Under a White Sky, it fits into her other work, right? Especially The Sixth Extinction.
Oh, absolutely. It's like the direct sequel. The Sixth Extinction was the diagnosis. Here's how we're causing this mass extinction event.
Right. Documenting the problem.
And Under a White Sky is like, okay, given that diagnosis, here are the radical, sometimes desperate treatments people are now seriously considering or even trying.
Treatments like geoengineering.
Yeah. Exactly. And she approaches these really controversial ideas not as an advocate saying this is good or this is bad, but as a journalist saying, look, this is what's happening. These are the options scientists are putting on the table because things are so serious. It's that objectivity that makes it powerful.
So the core idea is we've passed the point of no return in a way. We can't just, you know, minimize our impact and hope nature bounces back perfectly.
That seems to be the hard truth she's presenting. The idea of restoring some pristine, untouched wilderness, it's probably obsolete. We have to accept our role as managers, like it or not.
And she structures the book to show how we got here.
Yeah, it's really clever. She uses three escalating scales of intervention. It mirrors how humanity's approach has kind of snowballed.
Okay, what are they?
First, down by the river, that's about managing local water systems, ecosystems. Then, into the wild, focusing on biological and even genetic interventions.
Okay.
And finally, up in the air. That's where we get into the big stuff, atmospheric, planetary-level interventions, geoengineering.
Which is where the title comes from, right? Under a White Sky.
Exactly. That white sky is a direct reference to one of the most extreme ideas, solar radiation management, or SRM, which could literally change the way the sky looks by reflecting sunlight.
Wow. Okay. So the book maps out this landscape of choices for us, the planet's new self-appointed operating system managers.
That's a good way to put it. So let's start down by the river. What's a key example there?
The Chicago River reversal in 1900 is a big one she uses. It sounds completely audacious today. They literally made a river flow backwards.
Yeah, it's incredible engineering. But the goal wasn't ecological, right? It was sanitation.
Totally. They wanted to send Chicago sewage away from Lake Michigan, which was their drinking water source, and flush it down towards the Mississippi River instead. Solved one problem.
But created another huge one down the line. By connecting the Great Lakes and Mississippi basins, they unintentionally built a highway for invasive species.
Like the Asian carp.
Exactly. Now, these carp are threatening the entire Great Lakes ecosystem, a multi-billion dollar fishery. So the 1900 sanitation solution became the 21st century ecological nightmare.
And the fix for that problem, it's pure Colbert paradox, isn't it?
It really is. It's not like they can easily undo the river reversal.
Yeah.
So now the solution is these high-tech, very expensive electric barriers in the water. Essentially, underwater electric fences trying to zap the carp.
So old engineering requires constant, new, maybe even riskier engineering just to manage the side effects.
That's the cycle she shows again and again. Okay, so let's move into the wild. This is where interventions get biological and our whole idea of conservation starts to feel weird.
Yeah, the Devil's Hole pupfish example is heartbreaking, really.
Tell us about that one.
Well, this tiny fish is one of the rarest creatures on Earth. It lives in just one single small geothermal pool in the Nevada desert. Its existence is incredibly fragile.
And climate change, water issues, they threaten its only home. So how do scientists save it?
Not by fixing the original hole, really. Instead, they built a multi-million-dollar perfect replica of its cavern next door, like a high-tech lab simulating its environment.
Down to the water chemistry, the temperature gradients, even the LED lighting that mimics the exact sunlight patterns.
Exactly. So this wild fish is now essentially surviving on permanent artificial life support in a concrete tank.
It forces you to ask, right, what does wild even mean if a species can only exist with that level of constant, meticulous human micromanagement?
It dissolves the boundary, and that leads logically to the next step she explores, assisted evolution.
Right. We're going beyond just trying to preserve species as they are. We're
Right,
starting
sir.
to actively, redesign them.
The Great Barrier Reef is the key example here. Coral bleaching, ocean acidification. Traditional conservation efforts like marine parks, they just aren't enough against global warming.
So what are scientists doing? They're essentially trying to fast-track evolution in the lab. They're breeding super corals.
Corals specifically selected or bred for traits like heat resistance or tolerance to more acidic water.
Exactly. Trying to create tougher corals they can then plant back onto the reef, hoping they'll survive the conditions we've created. We're literally stepping into the role of directing evolution now.
And it gets even more radical than that, potentially. She talks about gene drives, right? For controlling invasive species like cane toads in Australia.
Yeah, gene drives are, wow, they are powerful. It's genetic engineering designed so that the specific altered trait doesn't just get passed on like normal. It spreads rapidly through an entire population, maybe even wiping it out.
It overrides normal inheritance.
Totally. It ensures almost all offspring get the trait. It's self-propagating, potentially irreversible genetic change unleashed into the wild. The power there is immense, and the potential for unintended consequences is terrifying.
That definitely feels like playing God. Which brings us to the final scale. Up in the air, global atmospheric interventions. Let's start with carbon capture. There's some hope there, right? Like the CarbFix project in Iceland.
There is. CarbFix is scientifically pretty cool. They capture CO2, dissolve it in water, and inject it deep into volcanic basalt
And
rock.
it turns into solid rock.
Yeah, it mineralizes surprisingly quickly. It literally locks atmospheric carbon away as stone. It's a genuine negative emissions technology.
Sounds great. Problem solved.
Well, Colbert always brings us back to scale. CarbFix works, scientifically. But the amount of CO2 we need to remove from the atmosphere is astronomical. To make a real difference, using technologies like this would require building a new global industry on a scale potentially larger than the current fossil fuel industry, just to capture and store carbon. Another massive human engineering project remaking the planet.
So even the good solutions involve massive intervention and infrastructure. There's no easy way out.
Seems not. And that leads to the ultimate, most controversial intervention discussed: solar radiation management, SRM, geoengineering the climate itself.
This is the white sky scenario. Explain it again. What's the proposal?
The basic idea is to deliberately cool the planet by reducing the amount of sunlight reaching the surface. The most talked about method is injecting sulfate aerosols, tiny reflective particles, high into the stratosphere.
Like mimicking a giant volcanic eruption. We know big eruptions can cause temporary global cooling.
Exactly. Mimic that effect, but continuously. But, and this is a huge but, it doesn't solve the root problem, the CO2 already in the atmosphere.
So the oceans would still get more acidic?
Yes. And you introduce a whole new set of massive global risks. What happens to rainfall patterns? Who decides the planet's temperature? What if one country does it and affects another country's agriculture?
And the scariest part Colbert highlights is the termination shock.
Right. If we ever started injecting these aerosols, we likely have to keep doing it indefinitely. If we suddenly stopped, maybe due to war or economic collapse, the planet could warm extremely rapidly, potentially much faster than it's warming now. The consequences could be catastrophic, almost immediate.
It sounds like the ultimate high-stakes gamble, trapped in yet another cycle of intervention.
That's the running theme, isn't it? This paradox of control. Every attempt to impose order on nature seems to backfire or demand even more control later on.
Like the Mississippi River levees she discusses, built for flood control.
But they starved the delta downstream of the sediment it needed to replenish itself. So the land started sinking, disappearing into the Gulf at an alarming rate.
Leading to massive land loss, increased vulnerability to storms.
Exactly. And now we're spending billions on new massive engineering projects like sediment diversions, trying to artificially mimic the natural sediment flow that the original engineering destroyed. It's just a spiral.
Which forces us to confront what Colbert calls the end of natural nature. That clear line we used to imagine between human and natural, it's just blurred beyond recognition now.
Yeah, the idea of restoring things to some perfect, pristine state before humans mess things up, it's probably a fantasy. We have to accept we live in and manage these hybrid, constantly changing systems. There's no back to go to.
And that reality raises the danger of moral hazard, right?
Definitely. That's the risk that just knowing these big technological fixes might exist, like geoengineering, could make us less motivated to do the hard work of cutting emissions right now.
Like, why bother changing our lifestyles or transforming our energy systems if we think some future tech will just bail us out?
Exactly. It potentially weakens the political will and societal pressure needed for fundamental change. It's a dangerous temptation.
Colbert really crystallizes these huge ideas with some unforgettable lines, doesn't she?
She does. They sort of stick with you. There's that quote she borrows, originally from Stuart Brand. We are as gods and might as well get good at it.
Wow. That perfectly captures the uncomfortable necessity of our new role, doesn't it? Like it or not, we have this planetary power now.
Yeah. And then there's the direct challenge to old school environmentalism. There is no going back to nature. Because there is no back to go to.
Accepting that the baseline has shifted forever.
Which leads to the practical reframing. The choice is not whether to intervene in nature, but how to intervene better.
So intervention is the given. The question is how we do it, hopefully more wisely this time.
And maybe the most concise summary of the whole book's paradox. We've created a world where the only way forward is through more technology, not less.
That's the core dilemma right there. Okay, so how can listeners take this challenging perspective and apply it? It feels overwhelming.
I think one key takeaway is developing what you might call second-order thinking. When you hear about any new solution, whether it's in technology, business, policy, don't just ask, does it solve the immediate problem?
Ask the Colbert question. Okay, what new problems might this solution create down the road? What are the unintended consequences?
Exactly. It pushes for a deeper level of critical evaluation, looking beyond the immediate promise.
That seems crucial for informed policy and investment, too. We can't just ignore these technologies anymore.
Right. Things like direct air capture, assisted evolution, maybe even geoengineering, they're moving from sci-fi to real-world possibilities. Mm-hmm. As citizens, as voters, maybe as investors, we need to actually understand them, weigh the risks and benefits critically, rather than just dismissing them out of hand or embracing them blindly.
It demands a more engaged, informed public discourse about what kind of future we're engineering.
And maybe the biggest application is fostering a sense of humility. Every chapter is basically a story of unintended consequences, of human cleverness backfiring.
Yeah.
It really reinforces the need for caution, for the precautionary principle, especially when we're talking about potentially irreversible planetary scale technologies like gene drives or messing with the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
We should be very, very careful about assuming we fully understand the systems we're trying to control.
Thinking back through the book, what was a moment or idea that really surprised you or stuck with you the most?
For me, I think it was the sheer scale and honestly the absurdity sometimes. The electric fence for the Asian carp is one thing, but the multi-million dollar replica cave for the pupfish. It just encapsulates the lengths we're going to, the almost tragic comedy of trying to manage these tiny details of ecosystems we've fundamentally broken on a macro level.
Yeah, that pupfish story is haunting. For me, the lasting insight, the big takeaway, is really about our species' maturity or lack thereof. Colbert shows we have the technological power, now we are de facto Earth's operating system. Mm. But the real challenge isn't inventing the next clever machine. It's developing the wisdom, the ethics, the global cooperation, the governance structures needed to wield that power responsibly. Our technology seems to be constantly outrunning our ability to manage it wisely.
That's a sobering thought. We've become gods, but maybe we're not quite ready for the job description.
A challenging idea to leave everyone with. Thank you for unpacking that.
Thank you. It's a vital conversation.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.